This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Sam Copper, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Well, glad to be here.
Now, you, many years ago, were working at WBCN in Boston, and you had the opportunity to meet Bob Marley, the reggae singer. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I had originally been at BCN doing the morning show and being the original program director, only changed it to rock and roll in 1968. Then I left the station twice, actually. The second time I came back, what I had been doing is building this Boston school bus-based mobile unit. Former Boston school bus had turned into two-thirds hippie motorhome and one-third little radio production facility in the back of it.
Right.
Well, that radio production facility soon morphed into very basic multi-track mixing capability. I say basic, there was like a Tascam 10 board in there. At first, I think I had all of about 8 inputs. Then I put 2 Shure mixes together. At some point, fairly shortly, I had about 14 inputs. And I was a firm believer in getting sound and music and so forth from where people make it. I get bored just sitting in a radio studio, which felt like kind of like a shoebox to me. And so my idea was to get out and get sound, but particularly musical performances, live from out in the world. So
right.
I came back to BCN and began to handle all of BCN's live broadcasts. Now, we would go to a club, for instance, Paul's Mall or the Jazz Workshop, and we would park in front or in back, and we would run our cables in, and we would do a completely separate mix that is separate from, you know, what you would do for a house mix, because house mixes are for the acoustics of that room. And our idea was to have this rolling control room, or this rolling recording control room, where we could do definitive two-track mixes, put them on Class A phone lines, which is to say high-fidelity stereo phone lines, and get them back to the radio station. So the artist is on live in real time.
Now, that was very cutting edge in those days, is that right? There weren't too many people doing that.
Right, that's true. There were a few progressive rock stations around the country doing it. Most of the live broadcasts that happened on these various progressive rock stations, soon to become called AOR stations, very often they would do it from a recording studio. So doing them live from actual clubs or concert halls was somewhat more rare, but you know, others were doing it. I was one of the few. So.
Right.
But by the way, if you hear traffic in the background, I'm walking down. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina, walking down the Savannah Highway.
That's okay. Sure.
So anyway, I'm always concerned with ambient sound, of course. So that's why I explained that.
Oh, sure.
So along came when I came back to BCN to do these live broadcasts. The very first one turned out to be Bob Marley and the Wailers from Paul's Mall.
And that was Freddie Taylor's club, right?
That's exactly right. Now, the Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop had been open since the early 50s. Fred Taylor originally had been bringing in pretty much, you know, the great jazz artists of the day. But by the late 60s and the early 70s, he began to branch out, and he was doing jazz, R&B, rock and roll, reggae, folk rock, bringing all that stuff through. And at the height of our live broadcast at BCN, we're doing as many as 3 live broadcasts a week. And one might be, you know, Jack DeJohnette, Patti Smith, and Orleans, or something like that. So it was a complete, very eclectic in terms of the artists we were doing. But Bob Marley and the Wailers was the very first that I did there.
Wow, that's quite amazing. Now, you met Bob and all of the Wailers that night?
Yes. Most of my story about that broadcast is a lot of fun and utterly inspiring. There's one aspect of it that's stone drag, but it goes like this. This was my very first broadcast for BCN, even though I'd been associated with the station for 6 years before that, 7 years. On that very first broadcast, we decided to park the mobile unit, the bus, behind the mall, Paul's Mall, in an alley. Now,
right.
I'll just dispense with the bad side first and then get onto the good side. The bad side was that the wiring in Hall's Mall was very bizarre. That is to say, the AC, the 110-volt wiring was weird. The stage monitor system was on one leg of the 220 circuit, the 240, and the house system was on the other leg. Well, what that created was two bad things. One is, artists were regularly getting themselves shocked, and they would lean up against where their lips would touch the microphone. They quickly realized they couldn't get their lips right on the mic. And it was, wasn't a full tilt, 110-volt shock or something, but it was...
There's a good blast.
So they might have been getting, 40 or 50 or 60 volts or something, enough to, definitely wake you up. But what it did for me was it caused buzz and hum problems that I spent the better part of the day trying to troubleshoot and trying to get around. So I started setting up at about 10 in the morning, and around noon, Bob Marley and the whole band showed up. And that was pretty rare. I mean, normally you wouldn't, especially since they've been there the night before, you wouldn't expect them to be sound checking that early. Most bands will come in as late as they can to sound check. But Marley and the whole band came in around noon. Now, at this point, I'm still pulling cables and trying to figure out how to get rid of this buzz and hum. And let's see. At this point in my musical life, I already dug reggae. I was already a minor fan. I was not a Dyed in the Wool fan. I was not, a fanatic for reggae. But I liked it.
Right.
Well, the first thing that I noticed as I was setting up my equipment was that out in the alley where, as I said, I parked the bus, that was the only time I did park in the alley. After that, it was out in the street. It was just funky in the alley. But I noticed that on every horizontal surface I could find in the alley, there seemed to be the remnants of a spleef. We're talking roaches that you could probably roll two large standard American
joints from,
right? And this was the roaches that were left out there.
The roaches were bigger than the average American joint.
Joint, that's correct. And needless to say, I noticed that right away. I didn't partake in any of those little too funky these roaches in the alley overnight. But that's obviously where the band had been taking some
refreshment.
Right. So, and obviously that was left over from the night before. Anyway, the next day, when I'm there, I notice all that stuff, and I'm setting up all my equipment, and the band comes in at noon, and they start playing, and the I-3s, the whole, almost the original band, I guess Tosh was not in it at that point, but it was close to the original band, and they start playing, and of course, they also start smoking. Now, Paul's Mall had about a 7-foot-high ceiling. Tall people would have to duck when they went in there. It was in a basement.
A cavern type.
Right. Yeah, you'd walk down from the sidewalk on Boylston Street into Paul's Mall. And very low ceiling. Within 15 or 20 minutes, you couldn't see from one side of the run to the other for the smoke, shall we say, that was spreading through the club. And it took the term contact high to yet another level. I mean, it wasn't a contact high.
It's like sticking your head in a bong or something.
Exactly. So they start playing and smoking. And I'll tell you what. I mean, I already liked reggae, but after that 2 or 3 hours that they just jammed and played, and with the, shall we say, spirit, soul-altering...
gas or whatever.
By the end of the day, it's like, I kind of like, this religion I can dig, I mean, there's lots of fire and things. And I, at some point I realized that I've been listening to Stir It Up for about an hour and a half. They jammed on Stir It Up. They jammed on that so long that it would take modern jazz, jam groove bands, so-called, and put them to shame.
Oh, really? They were really top-notch musicians, huh?
Oh, yeah. And it was, let's just put the pot and the ganja jokes aside. it was like a religious experience.
You would bring it to that level, as a mystical
Really, I mean, look, I heard one commentator say about a year ago on NPR, this guy said that he considered Bob Marley to be one of the, if not the greatest musicians of the 20th century, because not just his musicianship, but the messages of his music. His message was all the way from revolution to love, from getting out from underneath slavery to Three Little Birds, to man, woman, love. I mean, he kind of covered the gamut of the most important and heartfelt and soulful human emotions and needs, and did so with poetry that I just think is, you know, at the very top. And then you throw, you know, that kind of that masterful, feel for the music, the reggae beat. I don't know. It's the rhythm and the message of life and love and the other aforementioned human needs, freedom, and so forth.
Now, what were your impressions? Did you speak with Bob and the other guys?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, not at length. I mean, they were sound checking, and I was an engineer, so sure, you know, we talked about. We recorded some stuff, and they said, "Well, bring this up and bring that down." But, I mean, we didn't have any kind of
in depth.
Right.
Well, I would have rather listened to the music anyway.
Yeah. I just remember him as everything I just said about the message in his music was also truly him. I mean, he had a spirit and a soul that I just think was one of God's great gifts to this planet. And I think that when you see the pervasiveness of his image around the world today, and when you note how much more powerful his music has become and known, you know, and ubiquitous since his death, it's just, that's only because of the man that he was and the spirit that he was and is, frankly.
Very good. Now, just to jump topics a little bit, just so people know, did you actually work on the original Live Aid concert?
Yes.
And may I ask what you did there?
My mobile unit, by then not a Boston school bus anymore, but more like a Greyhound sort of a thing, I had broadcast the Boomtown Rat 3 times prior to Live Aid, so I got to know Geldof pretty well.
Oh, wow.
And so, now, you see, I described earlier about how we would pull up to a club and make some music and send it down phone lines to one station. Then by about 1980, we started doing the same exercise, but instead of sending it to one station, we sent it to 4 stations by way of, at first, special phone company lines, but then it went up on satellite. When the Reagan administration took a bunch of money away from NPR, they did allow NPR to start selling their satellite services commercially. So we used NPR's satellite system to every city, and then every city's radio station would get phone lines to the local NPR station, and that's how we got out to a lot of cities. My point of mentioning all that is, I think two of the Boomtown Rats broadcasts were multi-city hookups, little network hookups. And so Geldof had some respect for our ability to do that. And by the way, that's, you know, it is a bit of a science and an art, getting a rock and roll stage, you know, to start when the second hand comes up, and you know, making a rock and roll performance work for radio, both in terms of, you know, the audio quality, but also the production.
Oh, sure. It's a big task. People don't appreciate it, yeah.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's huge. I mean, you know, rock and roll artists don't normally want to be bothered with worrying about 5 minutes or 10 minutes this way or that, and you're asking them to, okay, you know, you start playing when the stage manager points to you.
Yeah, right.
So when I heard about Live Aid, I called Geldof and got through to him, and it was determined that our mobile unit, since our specialty was radio production, would handle the radio production for the feed that would go to the whole rest of the world, that is to say, outside of the United States. ABC had the United States, and we were feeding from our mobile unit 17 different countries.
Wow, that's amazing, huh? Wow.
Yeah, three of those countries had worldwide broadcast services, CBC in Canada, CBC in England, in Britain, and I think French radio as well, but in any case, there were three that were transmitting worldwide by, in those days, short wave. So, the thing that was thrilling to me from a technical standpoint was the realization that the signal that was coming out of our bus was hitting every square inch of planet Earth.
Wow, that's amazing, yeah.
You could have heard the show on the South Pole or on the North Pole and everywhere in between. And what fed us, so we did the radio production, and the music mixes were fed to us by three different multi-track mobile units, Record Plant, I think Chesapeake Audio from Maryland, and another company, I forgot the other one. But they would, you know, since the stage was changing so fast, the music mixing mobile units would, there'd be one on live currently, another one would be breaking down from the last group, and the other one would be setting up the sound check in the next group. And so it was kind of a lazy Susan of audio coming to our truck. See, I want to say this about Live Aid. You know, some people have disparaged that effort afterwards, saying that a lot of the money didn't actually get to the people.
Right.
That they were bandits that stole money and stole food and all that stuff. I don't know, you know, how much that thwarted the effort. But I will tell you, from a personal and a professional standpoint, Live Aid was one of the most, was probably the most important and moving thing I ever did in my professional life. And in my personal life, hey, it's right up there with being there for the birth of my two sons. I mean, it was just an amazing moment. For this reason, there were almost 5 days of all of us technicians setting up this city of wires and satellite dishes. In this huge stage, we worked the people were working 20-hour days for four or five days getting ready for the broadcast day. So we all went into this 16-hour broadcast day already exhausted. And here it was, you know, 85 or 90 degrees out in the middle of the summer. And in came, of course, the hundreds, literally hundreds, of artists, record company people, radio people, groupies, all of the people that, you know, you would normally see around one artist are there for scores of artists. So the backstage area at Live Aid was literally elbow to elbow. I mean, you could not help, I physically ran into Mick Jagger three times that day. Jack Nicholson was just standing in one spot for most of the day, just kind of looking at people with that Jack Nicholson expression on his face.
Right.
Skeptically at the world, but it seemed obvious to me he was just sitting there soaking up all this humanity in the scene. So all these people, you know, were jammed, were hot, they're all working hard. The superstars are working hard, the technicians are working hard, everybody's working hard, except, you know, the groupies and the other, you know, industry types that are just there to watch. But we're all busting butts. The spirit being backstage at a single artist rock and roll concert is always very ego-filled.
Right.
You know, oh, don't touch me, you know, that sort of thing. The spirit at Live Aid was the most beautiful spirit I've ever seen. I mean, it was, you know, that expression they said when they did the Christmas record, so they know it's Christmas, you know, check your ego at the door.
Right.
There was no ego backstage. Everybody was there for the cause. It just felt incredible. I mean, you saw, we were, you know, broadcasting from our bus. We had various, you know, artists come in, and we had these kids from Ethiopia come in and so forth and be interviewed. They're grown men and women crying. It was so moving.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. And it's odd when you see celebrities together like that. They're a bit taken aback, huh? At other celebrities,
I mean, everybody, like I say, everybody was there for the right reason, and they're I mean, I do have one slightly bummer story to say about it. So everybody's there the way I just described. About three quarters of the way through the day, I noticed this kind of rustle in the crowd in the backstage area, and I look up, and here come six cops walking in, flanking Madonna.
Madonna
fan, and before that, and when I saw that, I became even less of a Madonna fan.
Right.
Like, excuse me, Madonna, we don't care, you know? No one's going to touch you, don't worry, you know?
Well, she's a material girl, what do you expect?
I guess, I mean, you know, here's like, again, Mick Jagger, Lionel Richie, you know, all of this, later in the day, of course, Phil Collins performed in London and came on the Concord across and performed in Philadelphia. I mean, there are superstars all over the joint, and this one comes in thinking she needs to be protected.
From who? Phil Collins?
Yeah, right.
Well, Sam, we're about out of time, but I'd like to thank you for being on Sphinx Radio. And those the stories about Marley and Live Aid were absolutely wonderful. And I'll have you on again sometime, okay?
Great. I'll give you a little preview of another story I can tell you. A lot of people ask me, so out of all these people you live broadcast, who was the this or who was the that? Who was the nicest is one of the questions. The nicest, most professional, most easygoing.
Yeah.
That I worked with to put together a live broadcast and do it was Ozzy Osbourne.
Ozzy of all people, huh?
Total gentleman. A total sweetheart. I mean, he just was great. And so that's a little preview of other concert stories for you.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll have you back again, though, and I'd love to hear about Ozzy, because you don't hear very nice things about him, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, no, I'll tell you, he's like a lot of English musicians, I think. You know, a lot of the Brits have a stage persona. It's kind of traditional in British showmanship, I think. You know, they got a thing they do on stage.
And then they're just,
Whoa.
They're quite reserved the rest of the time, yeah.
Yeah, Ozzy's thing on stage is to be outrageous. Off stage, you know, he's a guy, he's a gentleman. You know?
Very good. Okay, thanks a lot again, Sam.
Thank you, and onward and upward with Sphinx Radio. More power to Sphinx Radio.
Very good, thanks.